Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Welcome to Looking at Lucasfilm with Brian Gaughan, the podcast with a different perspective on the world of Star Wars, Indiana Jones, and all of the other entities that George Lucas, Kathleen Kennedy, Dave Filoni, and Jon Favreau, as well as the rest of the team at Lucasfilm, have dreamed up over the past 40-plus years. I'm entertainer writer Jim Hill, and my co-host Brian Gaughan and I are recording this week's show on Tuesday, July 25th, 2023, and Brian is just back from spending, what, 5 days, 6 days down in San Diego? When did you do load-in, you and Bill?
Well, we went down there on Tuesday because that's the only time. If we did the preview day, which was Wednesday, we're exhausted and because we're getting to be old. So we always go down there Tuesday. We usually get there about 1:30, 2 o'clock. We're set up by 5 o'clock, we have a nice rest, and then we come in about noonish on Wednesday. We see all our friends, and we get ready for the preview. And it was really an amazing show this week. A lot of people came from all over the world. It was amazing. We met people from Austria. We met people from Italy, from Spain, from Mexico, from Korea. Everywhere. It was amazing how these people came in. Bill did really well. He sold out of most of his stuff, and three or four of his major paintings. Bill Stout, by the way. And a couple of people came by. Somebody came by on Wednesday, and I wasn't there. So I was disappointed that I didn't get to meet them. And then another family that listens to us from San Francisco, they came by, and they almost saw me get killed, to tell you the truth. What happened was, behind our booth, in another booth, somebody tripped over boxes which sent these panels that Bill has his paintings on, sent them crashing into my back. And I'm talking to them, and I see this horror on these six people's or five people's faces. And without even thinking, I put my hand behind me to stop what's ever falling, and it hits my hand, and everybody's panicking now, thinking that I was like knocked out. And at this time, this was, I think, on Saturday, and I had met a lot of people and had made a lot of friends in the different booths and stuff. And everybody came running and then said, and then Bill said, the first thing he said was, "You should sue." But I went over to the booth and I said, "Listen, everything's fine." I go, "Bill wants to sue, but you know, I don't want to. So everything's great. Nobody got hurt." But that was a lot of fun. But like I said, I met a lot of great people from all over the world doing different things. And it, again, it's 150,000 people of that are your friends that have everything that you have in common. And because of the strikes, there were no really big panels. There were some celebrities, like Jamie Lee Curtis was there, but she was there promoting her book. So there was things like that. But mainly because of that, everybody came on the floor. And this was the first Comic-Con that was done after COVID. There have been two before this, but they were all like people had to wear masks and stuff like this. And this was, you know, everybody just was having a great time, and they were ready to spend money. And they did. And they spent money not only with Bill, but on everybody. And everybody I talked to had a great show. And I had a lot of fun. And, you know, this is what I do. I abandon my family for 6 days out of the year. And nobody misses me.
Oh, that's not true.
Now, I know that's not true.
Now, okay, so you guys loaded up on Sunday night and drove home?
Yeah, yeah. Usually there was a party done by Graffiti T-shirts, but he has retired.
Oh.
And he didn't have a party, so Bill and I, we were done. It took us, it closed at 5, we were done at 7, and I started on the road at 7. For some strange reason, the 5 freeway was empty.
Wow.
Yeah.
So I think I was making the joke to Drew the other day because he was down there for Paramount. He and Charles Hood did the presentation on Thursday in a Hall H for Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtles Mutant Mayhem. They were the MCs for that. But I was making the joke that typically when you leave San Diego at the end of Comic-Con and get on the 5, it's like the Exodus scene in the Charlton Heston Ten Commandments. You know, always surprised not to see, you know, a camel moving slowly next to me on the 5.
Oh, I went to the Haunted Mansion party.
Oh, and?
Yeah, it was fun. It was, you know, basically it was just a place to have free drinks. And they had a little room that was like the a dining room in the show, and I put some pictures up there. They had a hidden Mickey, and I was with my friend. I go, look, come here. He goes, hidden Mickey. He goes, I knew there was a reason why I brought you here.
All right, so toward that end, folks, before we get to the actual news, we have to talk about our sponsor, and we actually have some news in regard to that, because Looking at Lucasfilm now has a new sponsor. Years now, Storybook Destination has been the sponsor of this podcast. And don't get me wrong, folks, I loved working with Tammy Whiting and the rest of the team there. They're good, good people who really know their jobs. But let's face it, folks, the only constant in life is change. And with that in mind, well, we've changed sponsors on the show. Looking at Lucasfilm's new sponsor, though, it's going to seem very, very familiar, and that's because it's Touring Plan's own travel agency. There we go. So those very obviously knowledgeable folks can now help you book your very next trip to Walt Disney World, plus toss in a free subscription to Touring Plan. So if you're headed to Florida anytime soon, please check them out at touringplans.com/travel. In hindsight, I'm beginning to wonder if perhaps Dr. Jones should have checked in with the Touring Plans folks before he headed off in search of the Dial of Destiny, because Indy's latest adventure has not gone according to plan. At least that's as far as the folks at Disney Studio thought it would go. And we're now 25 days after this James Mangold film was first released to theaters. Here in the States, Dial of Destiny has only sold $158 million worth of tickets, an additional $176 million overseas, with a worldwide box office total of $335 million, which, if somebody came to the house and handed me a bag with $335 million in it, I would be very happy. But if you talk with the folks at Disney, they've only just begun to talk about, yes, there's what we spent to make this movie, and then there's what we spent to make the version of Indy 5 that Steven Spielberg was going to make, and we'd started construction of sets, and then he walked away from the project in February of 2020. That $335 million only covers the production costs of this movie, not promotion. So they are still very, very much in the red. I don't know if you've been catching the drumbeat lately of this is Disney's time in the barrel. So, for example, Forbes just ran an article on how much it cost Disney and Marvel Studios to make Secret Invasion, and that was $212 million. But featured in with the story that Forbes did was also the amount that Disney spent on pre-production of the new, the upcoming Star Wars limited series, Acolyte.
Oh, really?
Yeah, $49 million on pre-production. Oh, not wow. Production, pre-production. If you think about what Barbie and Oppenheimer did just this past weekend, which really put in stark contrast how Indy 5 is doing.
Well, that was a fluke. Because I don't know if those films would have done as well if they weren't released on the same day And somebody had this genius thing to say, well, if you're going to see Oppenheimer, then juxtapose it with Barbie. And I don't think Oppenheimer would have made $77 million if it wasn't for this whole Barbieheimer thing going on. I think they both really benefited because, look, most films are underperforming at the box office right now. There's very few, and the ones that are not repeats, they're not sequels, they're not remakes, they're original films. Those are the films that are doing very well. What's happening is they're going to wait a month or two, and Indiana Jones is going to be on Disney Plus.
When you're dealing with a situation like this, you want to have a reason why this happened. And yes, as you just suggested, you know, there's a lot of folks who frankly are, well, I know Dial of Destiny is going to show up on Disney Plus, so I can wait. On the other hand, I was just talking with somebody in promotion, and they had kind of an interesting theory. When Indy 4 opened in 2008, over its opening weekend, it did over $100 million, whereas Indy 5 did 60. And what they put out there is, well, think about it. For Indy 4, George Lucas was an actual hands-on producer on that thing. And Steven Spielberg was the director. Okay, and these guys had been working on this franchise with Harrison Ford since 81. That trio, you know, walked out and did promotion together, and it was like, look at the secret sauce. You're getting Spielberg and Lucas and Harrison Ford all together on one project. Whereas with Dial of Destiny, I mean, Lucas was basically a producer in name only on this project. He was not hands-on when it came to story. Spielberg went from being the director to just a producer, which left only Harrison Ford, the last man standing of the original trio that made these films possible, that made these films special. And without Spielberg and Lucas out there also doing publicity for this movie, the project just did not have the heat that even Kingdom of the Crystal Skull did back in 2008. Now, we are a ways out from the end of summer, folks, when people will be doing the final tallies on box office. And as what's been going on with Pixar's Elemental, I mean, wrote that off when that initially opened, that Peter Somphone was the lowest domestic opening for a Pixar film to date. But that's continued to chug along this summer, more to the point, you know, it became this huge hit in Korea. So by the end of the summer, that's going to be a different story that people are talking about. But when it comes to Dial of Destiny, what I was hearing from one exec at Disney, it's like, thank God for the Flash. You know, yeah. Because at the end of the summer, that's going to be the story about, well, what was the biggest disappointment this year? Oh, the Flash, absolutely. But, you know, the folks at Disney's like, oh, this thing just keeps biting us in the butt. Did you see the lawsuit that got filed against Lucasfilm because there's a backpack company, I want to say the Frost River Company?
Yep. I guess they used the backpack without giving them any credit or without permission. They just grabbed it off the shelf or something. That and you know what? That usually doesn't happen.
No,
if somebody on a I've worked on film and I know that everything that is on film is always cleared.
Yep.
So it's weird that somebody just grabbed something. Maybe they made a backpack that looked like it.
Well, what's interesting is the story is they pulled all of the identifying marks off of it. So that, first of all, that kind of upset the Frost River folks because, you know, they would have loved people to go, oh, that's our, you know, where can I get that bag? And then I guess when they got asked by folks who made the bag, they made the mistake of crediting the bag to Frost River's rival, a company called Filson. And so it was, so yeah, that's dogging them. Then there's Karen Allen, who...
I know. Where she said the Spielberg version, she was more involved, and she did not like that she was heartily involved in this one. But whether it is or... I thought her scene was wonderful, was delicious, was really cute and clever and a good way to end the film, but...
Nobody's arguing that point, but when Spielberg was writing Herd on it, I guess Karen got to see a few of the scripts. In fact, what's kind of interesting is David Cope, who worked for a time on Indy 5, mentioned that it was actually one of the reasons that Spielberg walked away from the project, that there were certain storylines, certain ideas that he kept wanting to be put into the film. And it's one of these things where the term that was used was unworkable. And it's like Steven Spielberg came up with unworkable ideas. Did someone at the studio not want to do them? I mean, it's one of those things where it's like, that's an interesting piece of language right there. But evidently when you know, he just could not get his take on where Dr. Jones would be at this point in his life and his career into the actual shooting script of the movie, Spielberg decided, I don't want to direct this.
Do we know what that was?
I am working on it.
Okay.
I remain ever hopeful because, again, especially now in the middle of the actor's strike and the writer's strike and things are getting kind of mean out there, I would honestly be surprised if we don't have a copy of the early version of Indy 5 bubble up in the next couple of months. I would actually be shocked if that doesn't happen. But anyway, getting back to what Karen was saying, as I said, you know, Hollywood Reporter, she said when Steven was still going to direct the movie, I had an opportunity to read a few of the scripts and knew that Mary was going to be much more involved in that version of the story. But when Steven left and James Mangold, the guy who eventually directed Dial of Destiny after Spielberg left the project, well, he hired new writers, and I knew then that there was going to be this whole new approach to the project. And next thing I know, I'm reading a script that told the Dial of Destiny story, and of course, I was disappointed. I thought I would be a major part of this film, and that's just not the direction they decided to go. Did you see her explanation as to why they opted to go this route? That I think they had some problems in trying to resolve what to do with Mutt, because Shia LaBeouf was not coming back. And in order to deal with that character not being on the canvas, they decided to create this story where Mutt had been killed in the war, which then drove a wedge between Indy and Marion. I mean, I was happy when Indian and Marion came back together at the end of the movie, and I liked how that scene referenced the scene in Raiders where these two characters came together. But that said, I still wish that Marion had a bigger part in Dial of Destiny. Now, the whole Henry Mutt Williams, a.k.a. Henry Walton Jones III, Marion and Indy's son, he was supposed to be born out of wedlock in July of 1938. So, if we follow the story logic for Dial of Destiny, which is largely set in late July, early August of 1969, if this wound between Mary and Indy has to be fairly new. So, if you work that math, Mutt would have to have been killed in Vietnam in the winter of 68-69. Here's my problem with that. The men who were drafted to go to Vietnam were pulled out of a pool of healthy males age 18 to 26. And Mutt was older than that when he died. He was 30.
Well, 30 when he dies in Vietnam, supposedly. And usually it's like the younger men were going there. Mm-hmm. Were being drafted, but there's a point in it where it's a line where Indy says, "I didn't want him to go, but of course, with a son and a father, he went anyway."
Okay, but here's my problem. Mutt, as he was introduced in Kingdom of the Crystal Skull, think about it. He literally rolls into the scene on a motorcycle dressed like Marlon Brando was in The Wild Ones. And, right. And for those of you who don't know, The Wild Ones, famous Stanley Kramer-produced film, released at theaters in December of 53. Brando plays biker Johnny Stabler. And there's a line famous from that film to the effect of Mildred, I want to say a waitress character, goes to Johnny. It's like, "Hey, Johnny, what are you rebelling against?" And Johnny's response is, "Well, what do you got?
What do you got?"
So here's Mutt, this would-be rebel biker. That's the guy who volunteers to go to Vietnam?
Well, they could have done another thing. What if he went to Vietnam to protect temples or some kind of cool stuff that he was raised with Indy to do. I mean, what if there was something? They just said he was killed there.
Yeah, and I say this as a guy who volunteered to join the service back in 83, did 4 years in the Army. That story decision, killing Mutt off screen by having him volunteer to go into the Vietnam War. And remember, we previously have introduced this character as somebody who's adventurous, nonconformist, who rebels against authority. I'm sorry, that doesn't scan. I mean, look, it's not the main reason that Dial of Destiny stumbled at the box office, but it's one of many little things. And speaking of little things, when Brian and I get back from this break, we are going to talk about the Star Wars-themed keepsake ornaments that Hallmark had just brought to the market this year. You also might have some news in regard to Mr. John Boyega. Okay, Brian, earlier in the show, you were referring to having to make a run to Target. On the other hand, Nancy and I, tomorrow, we have to head out on our shopping-related errands. We're going to our local Hallmark store because Nancy has something to return there, and while she's handling that transaction, I'll be over in the keepsake aisle eyeballing the Star Wars stuff because, I don't know, have you seen, and I want to get the name of this right, okay, it's the Star Wars The Empire Strikes Back Into the Carbon Freezing Chamber ornament with light, sound, and motion.
Yeah, it's not an ornament. It's a scene put together, and it's got animation in it. It's got lights and sounds, and basically you see him go down and then comes up and he is in the carbonite. They had a whole booth at the Comic-Con with the ornaments. And by the time I got over there, not only was that one sold out, but nearly everything else was sold out.
Well, again, they know the audience that they're playing to. And by the way, this ornament got introduced, hit store shelves on July 15th. $64.99 all by itself. And in order to get it to play properly, you need an additional $14.99 power cord for your tree.
So
you are what? What is that? That's $80 in, you know, just so
what
you...
What is it? This is like...
This is like the
airlines. They keep on adding fees that we don't know what they mean. They just keep on adding on things. Here, buy this for $70. But if you want it to work, you have to spend another $20. I don't get that.
I know. It's the age we live in. But on the other hand, you know, face it, there are people who paid gladly
absolutely
for this because
and I would probably be one of those people.
Well, this Empire Strikes Back ornament sold out in many locations around the country. That's actually one of the reasons I'm headed to the Hallmark thing with Nancy tomorrow, just to see if we still have it locally. And by the way, if you prefer your Star Wars of a more modern era, they have a Mandalorian. I think this one's Grogu's Jetpack Adventure, so it's Mando carrying a baby Yoda. But again, that's going to set you back $24.99. And then, because this year we are celebrating the 40th anniversary of Star Wars 6, there are five different Return of the Jedi ornaments. There is a drink serving R2-D2. There is a Leia with Wicket the Ewok. There is Jabba's sail barge. And then the desert skiff that, well, the plan was to push, you know, Luke Skywalker into the Sarlacc pit, but that kind of went south.
Is there a Princess Leia in her bathing suit?
I think not.
Is she part of the Jabba thing? I mean, that those things always sell like hotcakes.
Well, and what's interesting is Brian just brought up there, the fifth in the series is a Jabba on his throne in his palace. In fact, it includes a salacious crumb. Yeah, but that one, whereas the first four Empire ornaments I was just talking, or excuse me, Return of the Jedi ornaments I was just telling you about, those are $24.99. The talking Jabba, that's going to set you back $49.99, and I bet you got to have that cord too.
No matter how bad the Star Wars movies do, or good, how much do they make in merchandise a year? Do we know the figures? And doesn't most of that go directly into Lucasfilm Disney's pocket? I mean, there's no middleman with those things?
You have to understand that companies license.
No, I understand that. But it's different than, I mean, we hear about how much movie it makes overseas, but mm-hmm. I heard Disney doesn't get a lot of that money, especially in China. I mean, they're lucky if they get a few yen mm-hmm. for the most part.
To circle back to the retail aspect, when you're somebody that, for example, license something, we were just talking about Baby Yoda, that if you license something with the real Yoda, as Home Depot has done for this holiday season. In fact, they have what they call their holiday Yoda, and that goes for $199
a piece. Now, it's not an inflatable, it's an actual like animatronic?
This is the thing. It's got a lifelike servo motor powered head and a mouth that moves realistically. It also has an LED lightsaber in authentic Yoda green that it waves back and forth. But again, note how they described it, holiday Yoda, because what's kind of interesting in our Haunted Mansion holiday world, this is something you can use for two holiday seasons, because it comes with, for example, a witch's hat you can put on Yoda for Halloween. It even comes with a little faux Halloween sign that reads, "Beware of the dark side, you must."
Oh.
Once Halloween is over, you can now dress Yoda in his Christmas outfit, which I believe comes with a Santa hat.
Well, so it comes with the Christmas too, so it's either or?
That is my understanding.
Oh, cool.
So, by the way, you mentioned inflatables.
Yeah.
Home Depot this year also has a brand new Darth Vader inflatable that comes with a tombstone. So I'm assuming that's Halloween, not Christmas. Likewise, there's a new 6 foot tall Mando and Baby Yoda inflatable. And
yeah, I already have one of those. Mm-hmm. I think each year they come out with ones a little different. And the one I had was the first year, where Mando's mm-hmm. standing there and he's got Baby Yoda, and Baby mm-hmm. Yoda's got a pumpkin, but it's the helmet of the Mandalorian.
Oh, so that's cute.
I got
that's
that. See, because what I do is I have half of my lawn is Nightmare Before Christmas, and the other half is anything Baby Yoda I can get a hold of. And I have Baby Yodas that are 3 feet, Baby Yodas that are 6 feet. You know, Mandalorians, the whole thing. But I make it just the Mandalorian Baby Yoda. There's no Yodas or Darth Vaders. I had to cross the line someplace.
Speaking of crossing the line, if we could move to the other side of the lawn that has the nightmare stuff. Have you seen this 13-foot tall talking Jack Skellington that's out there?
I don't know how they can keep it. If it's as skinny as Jack should be, mm-hmm. I don't know how it's not going to topple over. But I got to go check it out. Who has this? Is this also a Home Depot?
Might be Lowe's.
Oh, okay.
Got to warn you, this one is pricey as well. It's $3.99.
Oh, no.
Anyway, circling back to the Star Wars stuff. Sadly, if you check the inventory, there are no inflatable fins, which for me, that's kind of sad because I really enjoyed John Boyega's performance in the most recent Star Wars trilogy, especially in The Force Awakens. I loved his work with Harrison Ford in that movie.
Yeah, now it's like out of sight, out of mind. I mean, you know, Finn's not even in Disneyland, is he? He's not even at Galaxy's Edge.
I think Finn might turn up in Star Tours, the ride film there. Well, again, we're talking about John Boyega here, folks, of course, and John has been quite vocal in the past that he also believes that they didn't do right by Finn. And in fact, there's a famous quote from the 2020 interview we did with GQ to the effect of, well, look, as an actor, you get yourself involved in a project, and you're not necessarily going to like everything, but what I would say to Disney is, do not bring a black character in. Market them to be much more important to the franchise than they are, and then have them pushed to the side. That's not good. I'm going to say that straight up. And time has passed, and John has kind of softened his stance when it comes to the Star Wars trilogy and its missed opportunities. And earlier this year, for example, Boyega sat down with the Times of London and mentioned how, at this point, he's comfortable when he looks back on the experience he had with that Star Wars franchise. And he went on to say, look, for me, Star Wars made the man, in a sense. The experiences I had on that, the fun times, the good times, the ugly times, the bad times, it makes you who you are as you navigate through the industry. And that has definitely been interesting. And just this month, Boyega was talking with Tech Radar about Tyrone Got Cloned, which, by the way, got a great review, I want to say, in the Hollywood Reporter just today.
That's on Netflix, right?
I want to say, yeah. Okay. Yeah. But he got asked as part of that interview to the effect of, would you consider returning to the Star Wars universe? And Boyega, a very diplomatic response. What he said was, I'm open to all characters and scripts that are enjoyable, that have a great cast attached, and a terrific director. So, yes, I'm open to all opportunities, which is good to know, given that that Daisy Ridley project, the one that Lucasfilm is supposedly prepping, where Rey is now attempting to revive the Jedi Order by teaching the ways of the Force to two young kids. The subplot of this supposedly actually is built around Finn.
Oh, cool.
As far back as The Force Awakens, it was very strongly suggested that Finn was at the very least Force sensitive and potentially was strong with the Force. And it would be lovely after that story thread that got introduced in the first film of the new trilogy that never really then got followed up on. I'd love to see them finally circle back on that.
Remember when Damon Lindelof was writing his script for Star Wars?
Mm-hmm.
His story was going to follow, I don't know if he was a stormtrooper, but a black character. And then the same director who's going to direct it is now directing the Rey one. So I'm mm-hmm. wondering if they're going to use any of those elements that Lindelof brought in mm-hmm. to, you know, bring Boyega back. Because at that time, when Lindelof was talking about his script, Boyega was very negative about coming back to Star Wars.
Mm-hmm.
So they never mentioned if it was going to be a Finn story, because I don't think Finn was on the table at the time. But if Finn is on the table, it may have brought some, you know, some of that stuff from it.
I mean this in the kindest possible way, but given previously got invested in a Taika Waititi Star Wars movie and then a Patty Jenkins
right.
Rogue Squadron movie and only to not see those make it out the door. So it's one of these things where it's like, I look forward to this Rey project actually happening and then seeing if they actually manage to close the deal with John Boyega to come back and play Finn.
Now, when they mention Finn, do they mention Rose at all? Is Rose part of this?
All of the information to date is just those two characters.
Okay.
I also want to stress here, we are still in the middle of the writer's strike. SAG-AFTRA just went out. So a lot of this stuff is now officially on hold. And yes, there will be a lot of talk because people just like to talk and gossip. So I would love some more solid sources from people who are actually working rather than standing out on picket lines. But you have to remember when you're on strike, you always have to be thinking about what's the smartest move here. And it's like, we want to look strong. And what helps get that message across is, you know, being in front of cameras. I mean, a bunch of actors, there's a surprise. But what was fascinating to me were the stories earlier this month about how for a time they considered SAG-AFTRA going down to San Diego and picketing outside of Comic-Con International, outside of the San Diego Convention Center, because the notion is, well, think about all the cameras that are down there to cover that. And SAG-AFTRA management, after considering that idea, it's like, no, we need goodwill at this point in the strike. And the fact that if we go down there and picket, that just doesn't get us in front of the cameras. That also impacts, well, all the restaurants and the hotels down there. Likewise, all the people who have paid hundreds of dollars, whether it's for badges to get into San Diego Comic-Con or, for that matter, to stay in the hotels down there. It's like, no, better we stay up here in L.A. or pick it out in New York where, you know, we are not disrupting people's vacations or something they save for a year to do. There are other ways to get eyeballs and certainly better ways to get people to be sympathetic to our cause. So
for the most part, there were some people there. There were some celebrities there. I think actually there was a Indiana Jones panel, and it was basically the people who worked behind the scenes on it. But it would have been a regular one with the actors if they were there. But it was still pretty packed. It did really well. Some celebrities down there. Jamie Lee Curtis was down there, but she was pushing her book, and there were, other things. Mainly because there weren't any major Hall H or Ballroom 20 panels, people all went onto the floor, and it was like it used to be before Twilight. Twilight changed everything, and I think they're gonna see a lot of people who were talking there, a lot of people behind the scenes who had their booths out and stuff like that, said they would like it if they would scale back Hollywood, because it's not about Hollywood as much as it's about the people who go there. And when Hollywood gets there, they tend to, use this as their little thing to promote. But also, it gets lost in what Comic-Con really used to be.
Just think about the special edition, you mentioned the Comic-Cons, the reduced scale Comic-Cons that were held over the last 2 years or so, where people need to do masks. So people, Comic-Con is still finding its way back.
Right.
This strike, kind of interesting that the vendors on the floor did as well as they did. But I don't know as. There's so many publicists who love this event for
But up until the 2000s, the basic movies were a slideshow. You'd have a slideshow, and maybe you'd have an Arnold would be there or something like that. When Arnold Schwarzenegger did show up, it was a big thing because they had a lot of behind the scenes people, but they hardly had any celebrities. But now it's like, what has it become? It's become a fan fest.
But again, you can't unmake this omelet. I get what you're saying, and I understand what happened this year. But I also understand that there are hundreds of thousands of publicists out there.
Right. You're right.
And the tidal wave of press releases that came in my inbox just for this version of Comic-Con as compared to years previous, where it was like, do you want to talk to this actor? Do you want to talk to that director? That sort of thing. I don't see that stopping. Though, if we're talking about stopping, Brian and I obviously loved Andor, the limited series that was on Disney Plus, and they are now shooting in the UK season 2, or they were shooting season 2. Deadline reported earlier this week that because of the SAG-AFTRA actors going out on strike, the members of that film guild, SAG-AFTRA, left the production over in the UK. Now, most actors in the UK belong to Equity. I guess there was some discussion in sympathy and to support their brothers in SAG-AFTRA that the British Equity actors would walk out. And their union was like, look, in no uncertain terms, you can't do that. You have to stay here. You have to continue to work on the film. And so they're supposedly shooting as many scenes for Andor season 2 that they can do with just the people who are in Equity. But over time, they will run out of scenes and eventually they will have to shut down production. If we pivot back to Comic-Con, are you familiar with the outfit HasLab, as in the folks at Hasbro that do the special projects?
Right, right. That they do the special toys and stuff for Comic-Cons, basically New York and San Diego.
Well, here's the thing. Back in September of 2020, they decided what they would do is they were going to build a Razor Crest. In fact, it made it as far as, I want to say, season 2 before it got blown up.
But yeah. Wasn't that the one where all these people said, oh, we can't wait, we bought the Razor Crest, we can't wait, it's going to be the best thing ever done. And then they blew it up and they're going, oh my God, I have this thing now that doesn't have anything to do with the series.
Yeah, but I mean, this thing was huge. It's 20 inches wide, it's 10.5 inches tall, and then 30 inches long. And the thing is that HasLab basically put out, look, we'll make the Razor Crest if we get 6,000 backers for this project. And the thing is, when you signed up for it, you had to agree to pay $349 for this thing. Anyway, long story short, they didn't get 6,000 backers. They got 28,000 backers.
Of course they did.
I have to admit, I was kind of shocked myself, but Oh, mind you, it was supposed to make it be delivered fall of 2021. Missed by 4 months, but it hit the market in January 2022, but people loved it. So now, what did they announce this past Friday at Comic-Con? HasLabs is going to do The Ghost, Hera Syndulla's starship from Star Wars Rebels.
Wait a minute. Do we see the ghost in Ahsoka? Is that going to be in Ahsoka?
That it is.
So all right. We're going to see a real-life ghost versus the animated ghost.
Yep.
And this is going to be the real-life Ahsoka ghost.
That's how I understand it. Now, mind
that
you,
that is so freaking cool.
It is. It is. Now, it's also going to be freaking pricey. It's $500 a piece.
Oh, Jesus.
At that price point, it's like HasLab said, look, 6,000 backers isn't going to cut it. We need 8,000 people to pledge to buy this thing. And I'm pleased to report that they are already at 8,000. So it's going to be interesting to when this campaign wraps up to see how many people sign up to get themselves a ghost that they can then
is this going
put
to be out?
Dining room
is
table.
This going to be out like right away? I mean, when the Ahsoka comes out, will it be available?
No. Oh, no.
Oh, okay.
I want to say it's at least a 2 month campaign, and then on the other side of that, they have to go off and manufacture it. So,
okay.
The upside of that, folks, is it means that your dining room table will remain empty well into 2024, possibly 2025.
And who wants that?
Well, I have to admit, I'm kind of looking at it.
No, I mean, who wants the emptiness? You want it to be filled right away.
I could use an empty dining room table.
No. I mean, it has to be the whole Star Wars motif. You have to have the Death Star 1 and 2. Who needs a dining room table, to tell you the truth? You've got a kitchen table, right? You've got a TV tray.
Okay, speaking of Star Wars Ahsoka, when Brian and I get back in 2 weeks' time, it will be 2 weeks out from the debut of Star Wars Ahsoka on Disney+. That debuts August 23rd with two back-to-back episodes.
Oh, cool.
But I'm sure out ahead of that, there will be plenty Lucasfilm-related stuff to talk about. Till then, Brian, where can our listeners find you on social media?
Well, I'm still hanging out at Twitter, but it's Geek with Children. Mm-hmm. And the children is spelled C-H-I-L-D-R-N. And so I'm still there. But I'm trying to get, you know, similar stuff for, what's this thing called, Threads or something?
There we go.
Yeah, and trying to do that. I did put up a lot on my Instagram, and people have discovered me, and it was a lot of fun, you know, putting up, pictures and from Comic-Con and, you know, whatever stuff I found. So that's where you can find me. Where can we find you, Jim?
You can find me on the site formerly known as Twitter. I refuse to call it X. But again, I'm the guy who still calls Disney's Hollywood Studio MGM. also, on Instagram is Jim Hill Media, and on over on Facebook is Jim Hill Media News. Also want to remind you folks, we have a couple of other podcasts here we'd love you to take a listen to. We've got Disney Dish that I do with Len Testa. We also have Fine Tuning, which I do with Drew Taylor. And Drew, of course, has his own wonderful podcast, Light the Fuse, the official
Mission Impossible, right.
podcast, which he does with Charles Hood. And then, of course, we have Marvelous Disney, which I do with Aaron Adams, who in turn has his own podcast over on Patreon, 32nd Street, which explores the world of advertising. If you could do Brian and I a favor, if you could head over to Apple Podcasts and rate and recommend not just this show, but the other podcasts I just mentioned. Likewise, if you really, really like what you heard here tonight and you want to head over to Bandcamp and subscribe, that would be cool. On behalf of Brian, thanks for listening, and we will be back soon.